parties returned to Judge Denny Chin's Manhattan courtroom yesterday for motions in the Google Books case. The search engine giant sought to remove the Authors Guild as an associational plaintiff, even as the guild pushed for its own motion to certify the class of authors. And what about the publishers? Well, they were elsewhere, keeping busy with the burgeoning ebook market. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series, Beyond the Book. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week we speak with the editors and reporters of Publishers Weekly for a look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will all talk about when they return to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show today is Andrew Albanese, PW's Features Editor. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the
Book.
Hey
there, Chris.
Well, you're a regular here on our show, but you've become something of a regular in Judge Chin's courtroom. He may even recognize you by now. You were back there just yesterday. Tell us what you saw.
Yeah, so after more than 6 years in this case, most of which were spent pursuing the settlement that was rejected in March of 2011, Judge Denny Chin finally got to hear some oral arguments in his Manhattan courtroom yesterday. This case is kind of what I like to call Chin's side gig, because as you may recall, he was elevated to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals 2 years ago, but he's held on to this case, sitting by designation. And the Authors Guild and Google were in court yesterday to argue a couple of motions, including two overlapping issues, as you described: Google's motion to dismiss the Authors Guild as an associational plaintiff, and the Authors Guild's motion for class certification. After about an hour of argument, Chin declined to rule from the bench. That leaves the case's path very much open as we go forward. But inferring from the questions that he asked from the bench, it certainly seemed to me like Judge Chin wants to see the Authors Guild lawsuit against Google over its library book scanning program proceed as a class action suit. But it's pretty unclear if that's going to happen. The arguments yesterday offered up a real tantalizing preview of the arguments that are going to be made at trial, however, if it gets that far, including a preview of Google's fair use defense. One thing I do want to clarify, contrary to what some press reports stated yesterday, this was not about dismissing the case per se. So I want to be clear about this with some of our listeners. This was about, as you correctly stated, Chris, severing the Authors Guild as an associational plaintiff and establishing a class for a potential class action suit. Now, if Google wins, there's still going to be a lawsuit. It'll just be from the three named plaintiffs in the Authors Guild suit, not a class action.
Well, Andrew, you've been watching this case for quite a long time. You know the parties. You get a sense of the room. What's your feeling on the way things are shaping up?
Yeah, a few things jumped out at me during the oral arguments yesterday. I feel like the Authors Guild had a strong argument for pursuing their claims as a class action. Arguing for the Authors Guild, Joanne Zak cited the commonalities of the class. In other words, despite the individualized nature of copyright, there was more than enough common questions of law to merit the approval of a class. She said there were no unique circumstances or disagreements among class members, and the case only sought minimum statutory relief, which means that no one in the class would be seeking special treatment from the court. And all of the authors, she said, are affected by Google's digitization because virtually all authors, even those that signed away their copyrights, retain at least a royalty interest in them, and also a preponderance of copyright registration records provided a pretty feasible baseline for determining the contours of the class. I think most compellingly, though, Joanne Zak is the attorney for the Authors Guild. She argued that Google is an intimidating defendant, and those were her words, and that it would really be burdensome and unfair for individual authors to have to pursue their own claims against this big, rich company. And she pointed out that while Google is now asking for individual scrutiny of copyrights, the company certainly did not apply any individual scrutiny of copyrights in its own actions. It scanned entire collections of books off library shelves. So Zak basically argued that if Google could apply its program without regard to individual circumstances, it should be possible to answer common questions of law created by that program via a common action. That's certainly preferable to forcing such questions to be answered in costly, time-consuming lawsuits. And Chin seemed to suggest that he believed that as well. Zak even dropped this pithy quote on us, sort of channeling her inner Johnny Cochran. This action calls for mass litigation to adjudicate the mass digitization. I kind of love that quote. Zak also attacked Google's fair use claims. And, while Google likes to argue that this case just comes down to his display of the snippets. Zach really sort of, you know, put the press on that this is a case about copying. She argued that Google's scanning put the potential value of the entire book market at risk, both from possible piracy as well as from the preemptive closing of a potential secondary license market. And she cited an expert report included in one of their briefs from Harvard University's Ben Edelman.
Well, Harvard or not, Google has stuck by their guns. And what's their arguments?
Yeah, that's right. They have stuck by their fair use guns. And those guns, you know, are pretty high caliber in their own right. And I have to say, too, that Google's litigator, Daryl Landuri, is really one heck of a lawyer. She had a very good answer for everything that Judge Chin threw at her yesterday. And she really had no problem telling Chin where, she thought he was getting it wrong in his questions. As for the fair use stuff, the basic argument from Google is, not to be glib, but the only way to make an omelet is to crack some eggs. In other words, in order to create an index and provide snippets of books for this great, useful, transformational purpose, they have to scan the whole books. She argued that Google's program is legal, it's transformative, and it's actually beneficial to authors. And, the fair use argument pervades just about, every molecule of Google's case here. And she argued that these fair use determinations are complex and by law can't be made on a blanket basis. Among other things, Drury suggested that the court was also limited to deciding market harm on actual or probable markets. And she suggested, there really is no market that exists or potentially exists for snippets. But even if the court was to accept that there was a question about potential blanket harm to authors as suggested by the Authors Guild's expert reports, the fourth factor of the fair use analysis, she argued, requires harm to be balanced with benefit. So even if you buy that there's a blanket harm to the industry, the individual benefits of authors are much, much more difficult to look at and require being looked at on an individual basis. She also cited this contested $100,000 survey of authors that Google commissioned for its brief. And that showed that something like 45% of 880 authors that responded think that, Google Books is beneficial, and only like 19% think it harms them. That survey suggests, Drury noted, that despite the AG's claims of, hardship to the class, that really a large number of any potential class hold the exact opposite view. They think that this is a good thing for them.
Well, I'm going to take a closer look at that survey. It sounds interesting to find, I'm sure, plenty of nuggets in there with regard to how authors are looking at the benefits of digital, but publishers and others are seeing the benefits of the digital ebook marketplace.
Yeah, there was a lot of news this week, and it was very good news on the digital side. And you can read it all at publishersweekly.com, of course. The first thing was on Monday, Barnes & Noble announced that it was entering into a new subsidiary partnership with Microsoft. They have a new unit now that's temporarily being called NewCo, and God, let's please make sure that's a temporary name. But that's eventually going to focus on supporting reading applications for Windows 8 and the development of Nook reading apps, etc. So that's a big partnership in the digital realm that, just wasn't really there a couple of years ago, right? And, the other big news was that for Simon & Schuster, who reported that their first quarter was tremendous. They reported that their digital content sales rose something like 64% for the quarter that ended on March 31st. Its total revenue was up 14%. In addition to, higher digital sales that accounted for 26% of its total revenue was digital. Print sales also rose in the quarter. Now, part of that, I'm sure, has to do with a bestseller on the Steve Jobs bio from Walter Isaacson. But Carolyn Reedy said, SNS is looking for its digital sales to increase to about 70% for the year, to increase about 70% for the year, and that she thinks that digital is going to account for about, maybe as much as 30% of total revenue for the full year. We're getting to a tipping point in digital much more quickly than I'd expected. 30% is a big number. And she also noted with pleasure that total print and digital sales seem to be growing, that they're not losing readers, that, they're actually growing their total market. And this harkens me back to a point that was made yesterday in the hearing, because the Authors Guild's abstract claims of harm are beginning to sound so 2005. That's back when the suit was first launched, and since then we've got the Kindle and the Nook and other e-readers and this explosion of digital revenues. So if Google is hurting the book business, it's getting hard to see where. You know, in court yesterday, Drury even made a point of saying that Google's efforts will have to be put in context of the wider web world. And frankly, when you look at it this way, I think Google can make a pretty solid case that its program isn't harming anything. And in fact, they might be able to make a case that it is helping. You know, I can understand the Authors Guild's fears in 2005 at the start of this suit. But, you know, and certainly this business is going through a painful transition. You know, we all acknowledge that. But the sky has not fallen as they predicted it would. And all of the harm that they've sort of, you know, contended was going to happen is not really materializing. So I think that's going to be an issue at some point. And, you know, at the very least, I think it behooves us to look to put this issue about out of print books behind us and move on to where the real money is.
Well, it's still going to take a while before we can do any of that because the case grinds on. What's the timetable?
Well, there was no timetable from Chin as to when he was going to rule on the motions, but a ruling is probably going to come pretty quickly because the case is on an aggressive schedule. You know, after all those years we spent in negotiation of a settlement that was eventually rejected, Chin seems very eager to move this case along. So I would expect the motions to be ruled on pretty quickly. And, you know, as you mentioned before, noticeably absent from the oral arguments were the publishers, who are still said to be working on a separate settlement. And I'm pretty sure that settlement could happen any day now. And I've been saying that since September. So, you know, who knows? September of last year. But a Google spokesman did confirm those discussions were ongoing. And I would expect a settlement from publishers to happen soon. And it's going to be very interesting to see how that's going to affect the Authors Guild case. But after more than 6 years, the Authors Guild and Google could wind up at trial as early as September. There's motions for summary judgment that are due to be filed by June 14th, and all the replies are set to be briefed up by August 13th. So we could have a trial of the century this September.
Well, something to look forward to, and we appreciate, as always, the latest news from Judge Chin's courtroom provided to us today by Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor. Thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thanks, Chris.
And, you know, I have to say, I agree with you. They have to change that NewCo name. It sounds like a CIA front. Anyhow, moving on now to our review of the reviews. Joining me is Mike Harvke, PW's Deputy Reviews Editor. Mike, welcome to Beyond the Book.
Thanks, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great. And what have you got for us? I guess you've got some highlights from the general fiction section.
Yeah, to start with... you know, author Mark Fitton was born in Brooklyn, but he spent much of the 90s traveling in Europe and in that time called Hungary his home. And that country was the setting for his debut novel, Valeria's Last Stand. And it's the setting for his new novel, Elsa's Kitchen. This week's issue features a really great in-depth Q&A with Fitton about communism, Hungarian cooking, and writing books about women. In reviews, we've got some great stuff. People are calling Megan Abbott's new novel, Dare Me, Fight Club in a Cheerleading Squad. I like to call it Fight Club with Pom-Poms. I think it's a little punchier. Apparently things just get, you know, just as tense and bloody in this book. So we had Abbott's last book, the psychological thriller, The End of Everything, on our 2011 Best Books of the Year shortlist. So to quote the Capitol Pictures studio head from Barton Fink, we're all expecting great things. And we'll be running a profile of Megan in the magazine soon. We also have a starred review of a very different book, When in Doubt, Add Butter, by bestseller Beth Harbison. It's about Gemma, a private chef who cooks for a different client every single night of the week. And on Friday, at some point in the book, she gets two clients. So she's really rushing around. When Gemma has a red-hot fling with a guy from a bar, however, complications work their way into the kitchen. We say this is a perfect blend of chick lit and women's fiction, and we'll also be running a Q&A with Harbison fairly soon.
Well, I understand the issue coming out this week features your first signature review since you've commissioned the magazine since taking over as fiction editor.
Yeah, that's right. I actually took a trip recently down to Oxford, Mississippi, where I met Chris Offit, great Southern writer, and he has written a signature review for us. Offit's written a number of books over the last few decades, including the memoir No Heroes and a really great story collection called Kentucky Straight. He's also written a number of episodes of True Blood and Weeds, and is currently teaching down at Ole Miss with Tom Franklin, another Southern writer I love. Offutt thinks of himself primarily as a writer of short stories. He's published, you know, well over 50 in journals, and has had more than the one collection of stories. So he reviewed a book called Battleborn for us, which is a debut story collection by Claire V. Watkins, a young writer from Nevada, and Offutt just has a lot of love for this book. There are also a couple box reviews of interesting books in the issue. One is by a writer, Luke Geddes. It's his debut short story collection, and it's called I Am a Magical Teenage Princess. It could also be called Having Lots of Naughty Fun with American Pop Culture Icons. Geddes puts a twist, often of a sexual nature, on archetypal characters from the 50s to the 80s in stories like Surfer Girl, or my personal favorite for its title alone, And I Would Have Gotten Away With It If It Wasn't for You Meddling Kids. In that one, he's having a lot of fun flipping the usual Scooby-Doo point of view over to the villain. There's also a modern Stone Age story called The Modern Stone Age, which finds the Flintstones town of Bedrock just awash with wife swapping, and Archie Comics' Betty and Veronica in Geddes' hands, struggling to hide their sapphic love for each other in the halls of Riverdale High. So he's having a lot of fun there, and it's a really unusual debut collection. Then in what we think is a skillfully plotted and richly metaphorical debut novel, Michael Poore takes readers from the beginning of time to a media-obsessed present, tracing a quest by Satan to make Earth smarter, shinier, and braver. It's not a criticism at all to say that the devil here has some of Forrest Gump in him. He shows up in Benjamin Franklin's lab on the battlefield in 1776 alongside George Washington and in the White House with JFK. He even, this probably won't come as much of a surprise, has his own reality television show. But underneath all the clever time travel, it's really a love story, and Poore really pulls this off. And I guess you could say that Forrest Gump is really a love story too. Anyway, it's called Up Jumps the Devil.
Well, the devil appears, he jumps up in that title, but he appears as well in another book this week.
Yeah, this is in the mystery and thriller section. The dark little dude can be found in the title of John Verdon's Let the Devil Sleep, which is his third Dave Gurney whodunit. Verdon shows that there's a lot more that can be done with the old serial killer plot. This time, Gurney gets on the trail of a serial killer who's targeting drivers of black Mercedes, or is it Mercedes's? Not sure. As part of his crusade against the wealthy, so it's quite timely with all the Occupy stuff going on. And in Mystery Thriller, there's also Robert Ampuero's The Neruda Case. It's the Chilean author's English language debut, and it's set in 1973 with Nobel laureate poet and fellow Chilean Pablo Neruda battling prostate cancer. Well, he hires an amateur detective to go to Cuba to look for an old friend, and that's sort of the basis for that book. We say to read this one as much for the story as for Ampuero's wonderful way with words. There are also a couple of features on regional writing in this week's Mystery Thriller section. One of them looks at six authors who are making the most of their rural settings, from Arkansas to Alaska, and another one digs into the mysteries set in Florida, dispelling along the way the myth that Florida crime writing began in 1964 with the appearance of the first John D. McDonald's color-themed thriller, The Deep Blue Goodbye. We say it goes back, you know, a lot farther than that. It's fun stuff for mystery fans. In sci-fi this week, British novelist Christopher Priest creates a mind-bending, head-scratching book that's already been, you know, much lauded in the UK. I'm not even going to attempt to summarize. It is kind of insane. It's called The Islanders, and we think it's wonderfully fascinating, occasionally frustrating, but entirely unforgettable. Elsewhere in romance, Susan Moody believably conveys the childhood trauma of a girl whose paranoid mother dragged her around the world for the first 11 years of her life, only to then disappear for the next 10. Moody uses the stream of consciousness form to create really complex characters in these two wounded women. And we think the novel, it's called Dancing in the Dark, is another winner from Moody.
Well, you know, Mike, there's no business like show business. And this week's nonfiction section features several books by actors, musicians, and also soldiers.
Yeah, that's true. We've got a no-holds-barred memoir by Sopranos and Matrix actor Joey Pantoliano, or Joey Pants, as he's known to friends. And I actually had a friend that lived right next door to him for a while in Santa Monica, which was interesting. Got little tidbits there. There's also a cool anthology of the songs of the Beach Boys, and what promises to be a really big book called The Letter, My Journey Through Love, Loss, and Life. This is a memoir and letters by Marie Tillman, whose husband Pat, the Arizona Cardinals safety, gave up a lot more than his football career when he enlisted in the Army in, you know, a patriotic response to 9/11. His brother enlisted back then too, giving up his own chance of a pro ball career. And 2 years later, Pat was killed in action in Afghanistan. People probably remember back, you know, in 2004 when this became a big story because of conflicting reports over how Tillman died.
Well, it's fascinating, Mike, to see how we're beginning to see, you know, a real boom in literature, memoirs, otherwise, from the Iraq and Afghan wars. And there's another soldier featured this week.
Yeah, absolutely. We actually have a Q&A with Brian Kastner. It's really fascinating. After heading an EOD, which is an explosives ordnance disposal team, during two tours in Iraq, Brian found himself unprepared for a return to civilian life. And we talked to him about the mental and emotional damage caused by war and his difficulties reassimilating into civilian life. We reviewed his memoir. It's called The Long Walk, A Story of War and the Life That Follows, back in March. It was really good stuff. You know, before we move on into other sections, I'd like to say a little bit more about a couple of the books before. The Beach Boys one is called 50 Sides of the Beach Boys, The Songs That Tell Their Story. It's by Toronto-based journalist Mark Dillon, and he tells the story of the Beach Boys in this book through the window of their music. And we say that it's well-written and relevant to today's music scene. It's also perfectly timed because the Beach Boys are commencing their 50th anniversary tour this summer. And then, you know, my favorite, Joey Pants. Thanks to The Matrix, The Sopranos, and Bound, a cult classic, Joey Pantoliano is sort of a household name these days. You know, for Gen Xers like myself, he'll forever be Guido the Killer Pimp from Risky Business. His memoir is called Asylum, a memoir about Hollywood, mental illness, recovery, and being my mother's son. The actor really lays himself bare, talking about his clinical depression, his dyslexia, his ADHD, his controlling mother, and his belief that moving to New York to study theater would release him of all of his dark moods. It didn't. Instead, he found himself battling addictions to alcohol, drugs, food, sex, spending, and stealing, all as his fame was on the rise.
Yeah, well, you know, as if sex, drugs, and rock and roll weren't enough for this week's review section, there are some other obsessions as well.
Yeah, a few. Portrait of a Novel, Henry James and the Making of an American Masterpiece, is a really innovative biography from Michael Gora. He tells the life of Henry James through the story of the composition of The Portrait of a Lady. It's a highly engaging introduction to Henry James and really great for anyone who wants to learn more about the craft of novel writing. I think it's akin to, you know, Milan Kundera's The Art of the Novel, in a way.
Well, James's obsession, of course, was writing itself, and he always seemed to chew more than he bit off. That would be my commentary on Henry James. Actually, it was Henry Adams who said that first. And finally, speaking of chewing, you've got two cookbooks coming out.
Yeah, delicious stuff. One is a solid book of creative vegetarian recipes, and another is by a woman who blogged about all the recipes she made from 1998. These are both by bloggers. So in our starred review of Herbivoracious, say that 10 times, we say that it feels at first like we've seen author Michael Natkin before, another writer of a popular food blog with a tread lightly earth-friendly attitude about eating. But then he busts out recipes for Ethiopian fava bean stew and a dish called apio, or apio. I'm not exactly sure even how to pronounce this. It's lemony celery root, which sounds quite tasty. And, you know, so he lets you know pretty quickly that you're not actually reading the same old collection of vegetarian recipes. So, you know, I think bored vegetarians and even conscientious carnivores will appreciate what we think is an excellent collection. And finally, The Locavore's Dilemma, in praise of the 10,000-mile diet, is by Pierre Desrochers and Hiroku Shimizu, a Canadian academic couple who in this book attempt a soup-to-nuts debunking of locavorism and what we think is a daring, bare-knuckled, and frequently sarcastic defense of the status quo in Western industrial agribusiness.
Well, Mike Karfke, PW Deputy Reviews Editor, thanks for the review of the reviews this week.
My pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
And Andrew Albanese, as always, we enjoyed having you on the program.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here.
We should tell people that Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as now images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.